From WNYC New York Public Radio, I'm Leonard Lopate, and this is Please Explain. It's estimated that roughly 4 million Americans have Alzheimer's disease, and with baby boomers aging, that number is expected to triple by 2050. On today's Please Explain, Dr. Norman Relkin, a physician at the New York Presbyterian Hospital Weill Cornell Medical Center, and Dr. Nikolaos Garmeis, clinician and assistant professor of neurology at Columbia University Medical Center, will be answering your questions about Alzheimer's, and we'll be taking your calls in a little while at 212-433-9692. So let me throw this out to both of you. What is dementia, and is Alzheimer's a form of dementia? Let's begin with you, Dr. Scarmeas.
Dementia is the description of a condition. It means loss of brain skills, loss of brain abilities that we used to have in the past, and now we do not have them anymore.
Is this different than senility?
Senility is a term that is not used nowadays very much. So in the past, thinking and memory changes that people used to have, they were attributed to old age or senility, but now we know that they are a result of a brain disease. So dementia could be caused by a series of underlying conditions or diseases, the most common of which, in particular in old age, is Alzheimer's disease. Therefore, Alzheimer's disease is a cause for dementia, a type of dementia.
Dr. Relkin, you've said that the one very characteristic feature of the disease is a loss of insight. Does that mean that Alzheimer's patients don't realize something is going wrong?
Quite commonly, that is the case. It used to be said that when people brought themselves to attention for memory problems, they probably didn't have Alzheimer's disease. Nowadays, we don't believe that quite as much. There is a stage that people go through, a prodrome, if you will, to Alzheimer's. Many people now call that a state of mild cognitive impairment, in which the insight loss that occurs later is not yet present. And those individuals are quite aware of their memory loss. Formally, we don't consider them to have Alzheimer's disease yet, but they're in a state of very high risk for developing it in the not-so-distant future.
And is forgetfulness one of the early symptoms of Alzheimer's?
It's more or less the hallmark feature of most cases. Because of the peculiar way that disease passes through the structures of the brain, for reasons that we don't yet understand, it has a particular predilection to start showing signs and symptoms in the regions of the brain that are involved in memory, and in some respects spreads to other regions of the brain and picks off one function after another in sequence.
When should you start to worry, or when should the people who are noticing this sort of thing start to worry?
There are some criteria that one can read about on websites like the Alzheimer's Association website, 10 warning signs of Alzheimer's disease. But a good rule of thumb, since we all forget and forgetfulness is part of normal life, is that when memory loss or other cognitive symptoms begin to interfere with daily routine, when they compromise people either in terms of pursuing their livelihood or their social interactions, or really are getting in the way such that they're starting to constrain what they do, that's a good point to get memory and thinking abilities checked.
Dr. Scarmeas, is it true that it can't be officially diagnosed until after death?
There are different levels of diagnostic certainty regarding this disease. So we have what we call definite Alzheimer's disease, which can be diagnosed only by examining the brain, which is usually after death, as you said,
and
brain
autopsy, or
during life sometimes if we take a biopsy of the brain. But we rarely recommend that because it's an invasive procedure. But then beyond that, the next level of certainty is what we call probable Alzheimer's disease, which means that we do not have the pathological confirmation, but everything else, the history, our examination, exclusion of other diseases, points to this diagnosis. And although we cannot be definite about the diagnosis, in particular in specialized centers, the accuracy of this probable Alzheimer's disease diagnosis is very high. It's between 80 and 90%. So Most times we are correct about the diagnosis, although we cannot be definite.
So you could be surprised either way. You could look at the brain and say, gee, we thought it was Alzheimer's and it turned out to be something else?
That's correct. But this possibility is in the order of maybe 10 or 15%.
That's still high. Is it possible for depression to result in symptoms which are similar to Alzheimer's?
This is a complicated issue. Because Alzheimer's disease, because of chemical changes in the brain, manifests itself not only as memory and other thinking problems, but also as mood problems, one of which is depression. So oftentimes Alzheimer's disease patients, they manifest symptoms of depression, and oftentimes it could be one of the early symptoms in Alzheimer's disease. So sometimes when we have depression early on, we do not know whether it's a completely different disease or whether it's one of the early manifestations of Alzheimer's disease, and then in a short time, memory and other thinking skills will be affected.
My guests are Dr. Nicolaus Garmeis, clinician and assistant professor of neurology at Columbia University Medical Center, and Dr. Norman Relkin, a physician at the New York Presbyterian Hospital, Weill Cornell Medical Center. We're talking about Alzheimer's disease on today's Please Explain on WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Dr. Relkin, how fast does Alzheimer's usually progress?
It does depend upon the age at which it begins and a number of other factors. The average life expectancy from the time first diagnosis recently was revised, and it used to be that we told people average life expectancy was about 9 years. That's been revised down to about 6 because it takes into account that many more people are surviving to advanced ages, and they don't live as long anyway, regardless of whether or not they get the disease. So if you take into account those changes in the population and the distribution of ages of people getting the disease, it covers a span of about 6 years, with some variation on either side of that. And it passes through stages, mild, moderate, and severe stages, which again average about 2 to 3 years in length in an untreated patient, and progresses from a state of relatively mild dysfunction to one of total incapacity in the very severe stages.
And it's the Alzheimer's itself that causes the death?
Not directly. People die from the complications of the disease, and that may be their immune system may be compromised owing to decreasing nutrition. They may be subject to infections, or they may aspirate food. They become bedbound. They may develop bed sores. So it's usually these secondary complications that are ultimately fatal, not the disease itself.
In the same way that AIDS generally is not the thing that kills you, it's the all of the other illnesses that come along as a result of the AIDS.
That's true.
Now, Dr. Skamaeus, are there ways of slowing the progression of Alzheimer's?
We have some medications that we are using to treat Alzheimer's disease. So what these medications do is that they may slow the progression of the disease, but this is happening only temporarily, so they cannot change the course of the disease overall. So we don't really have good pharmacological interventions to change the rate of decline of this disease.
Although every once in a while I'll read an article in the paper that says there's been a breakthrough and then not hear anything after that.
Well, not to spread cynicism, I think that we are in an age of very rapid expanding knowledge about the treatments of the disease. And to some extent, the current therapies, there are 5 approved drugs, have been cast in a rather negative light. I've been involved in the field long enough to remember when we didn't have any approved medications to treat the disease. And I can tell you that the natural history, the course of things was quite different back then. All we could offer in those ancient times before 1993 were symptomatic treatments for things like depression or agitation associated with the disease. Now what we're able to do with the available medicines is prolong the amount of time that the person retains some of their basic functions, so that the duration of that mild and moderate stage may be longer.
Well, how do the medications do that?
Well, the medications that we have right now are viewed as purely symptomatic therapies. They're changing the chemistry of the brain and repleting neurotransmitters that are affected by the death of brain cells due to the underlying disease. Now, that view of these drugs is born out of, I think, inadequate testing of their full range of mechanisms. And some very, very interesting things have turned up in recent years when new techniques have been brought to bear on people treated with these drugs for longer periods of time. And one of those things is that the rate of shrinkage of the brain in now four different studies has been shown to be slower. If these were purely symptomatic band-aids, as most doctors have come to view them, we wouldn't be seeing the rate of shrinkage of the brain slowing. So they may have some effects that are surprising, but were never really pursued in the relatively short 3 to 6 month clinical trials that led to their approval.
Dr. Skirmay, is the brain shrinking because the nerve cells are degenerating?
Even that is not absolutely clear, but most people would say because of the death of nerve cells, the population of the brain in terms of cells is depleted, and that results in shrinking of the brain, which is a sign of degeneration, as you said.
What are plaques and tangles?
The pathological hallmark of Alzheimer's disease is the deposition of two chemical substances. One is called beta amyloid, and it's deposited outside the nerve cells, in between the nerve cells, and forms what we call amyloid plaques. And the other is a protein that is called tau, and this is deposited within the nerve cells, and it forms structures that we call tangles. And so when we look at the brain of somebody with Alzheimer's disease, we see these two depositions, amyloid plaques, which is beta amyloid, and neurofibrillary tangles, as we call them, which is tau protein.
Dr. Elkin, I was told once that the losses of ability occur in reverse to how they were acquired during infancy and childhood. Is that true?
To a certain extent. I know Dr. Barry Riesberg at NYU was a strong proponent of that view. It's true for reasons which may be less important than perhaps one might believe. The progression of the disease does, as I mentioned before, pick off one area after another. And it starts at these memory centers and progresses to areas of the cerebral cortex, the centers that modulate give us our highest thinking abilities. In a way that goes from very complex centers down to very fundamental ones. So the basic functions that we're all born with of being able to see and hear and touch and feel are the last to be affected because they're the most distant in a brain connection sense from those higher integrative areas. The importance, I think, clinically of that observation is it's sometimes helpful for people who are caregivers for Alzheimer's patients to understand the level of function that can be expected, say, in the next year. So if you use the analogy that a person in a fairly advanced stage is functioning roughly like a 6 or 7 year old, you wouldn't leave a 6 or 7 year old at home. You wouldn't allow them to drive a car. It gives people who may have parenting skills and experience raising children a sense of what kind of caregiving they need to give to an affected loved one.
Is it true that people with higher IQs tend to experience a slower progression of the disease?
I think, Dr. Skirmay, you've worked on that, haven't you?
Correct. This is this is, again, an issue of debate. It has been shown that higher cognitive reserve, by cognitive reserve we mean increased brain capacity as a result of either high IQ or higher education or more demanding occupational attainment or more engaged lifestyle, is associated with decreased risk of getting the Alzheimer's disease or getting the Alzheimer's disease at a later on. However, the effect of these factors after you get Alzheimer's disease is not entirely clear, and actually there's some evidence that if you have these higher cognitive reserve skills like high IQ, you may even decline faster after that. So in other words, what we think is happening, if you have these high skills either as fact of your genes or as a result of your education or your lifestyle, you may delay the clinical onset of the Alzheimer's disease because you may be able to cope better with the Alzheimer's changes in your brain. But then after the disease is finally manifested, these coping skills are not enough and you may decline faster.
But are you also saying, as I think some newspaper articles have suggested, that before the Alzheimer's, if you are somebody who does crossword puzzles and who reads books and does all sorts of other things that keep the brain engaged, that you might very well be able to stave it off?
You may be able to delay the manifestations of the disease. So although the pathology, the changes, the plaques and the tangles that we mentioned before, they may be happening in your brain, they may be accumulating in your brain, you may be able to compensate for them by, let's say, for example, let me give you a scenario. You may have higher number of neurons or connections between neurons. So if some of them are affected by the Alzheimer's pathology, you may use more healthy ones remaining, or you may have more efficient brain networks. So if there's some dysfunction in one of them, maybe some other one can take over. But there's no good evidence that doing these things in your life can really decrease or eliminate the actual changes that accumulate in the brain.
Before we go to the calls, I just want to cover a few things with you, Dr. Relkin, about what might cause Alzheimer's. We've heard everything from aluminum in the environment to aspartame, other artificial sweeteners, head trauma, and, of course, a genetic predisposition. Have any of them been determined as real causes?
Well, cause is probably not the right word to use. Alzheimer's disease is results from a variety of factors, all of which are feeding into kind of a common pathway. With the possible exception of aluminum and aspartame, I think anything virtually that you've seen in the newspapers as a potential risk factor on its own, with only a few exceptions, is probably not. Aluminum and aspartame have, to the best of my knowledge, not been proven to have even an interactive effect with Alzheimer's disease. What we see is that individuals who have a genetic predisposition, and that may be by virtue of having a family history or by virtue of having one of the identified Alzheimer-related genes, those individuals, if they have life experiences which include exposures to risk factors, and that may be risk of vascular diseases, high cholesterol has been a factor that interacts with genetics as an example, if they have had head trauma, or any one of a number of other factors, those individuals are more likely to develop the disease before dying of other causes. On the other hand, if you get one of the genetic protective factors like APOE2, and you avoid those life exposures, maybe a good diet, maybe staying mentally active, those will lead to a later onset, if any onset at all, making it more likely that you die of other causes before developing the disease.
My guests on Please Explain are Dr. Norman Relkin, a physician at the New York Presbyterian Hospital Weill Cornell Medical Center, and Dr. Nicolaus Garmeis, clinician and assistant professor of neurology at Columbia University Medical Center. We'll be taking your calls when we return from a brief break. Our number, 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. A reminder that we want to hear your thoughts on breakups. Compose an essay about ending a relationship with a lover, a hairstyle, a car, you name it, and then log on to WNYC.org to submit your essay. The deadline is Friday, June 22nd, and my brother Philip Lope will pick the winning essays and discuss them on the air on Thursday, June 28th. But please, no essays that have already been published. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. We're also available as a podcast. We're back with Please Explain, and my guests, Dr. Nicolaus Garmeas and Dr. Norman Relkin, and we are taking your calls at 212-433-9692. Morgan from Long Island, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello, yes. I have a brother who's 74. He's in mid-stage, I would say, Alzheimer's, and we have nothing genetic. We have a lot of relatives well into the 90s. Nobody's ever had this, but he's lost his vision. That's why I'm calling. And he's been checked by a number of ophthalmologists, and his eyes are fine. And I want to mention the PET scan says cortical vision preserved. So my question or guidance I'm asking for you, are you familiar with something like this, and how would you guide us from now on?
There is a condition which is called the visual variant of Alzheimer's disease. It has in the brain the same sorts of changes that are seen in most cases, but the distribution, the pattern of those changes are different. I mentioned earlier that Alzheimer's disease dysfunction usually starts with memory. In a very small number of cases, it will start in the visual system, and it will cause symptoms which are resemble having inability to see, but the actual problem is more one of inability to put together the pieces of the visual scene. Does your brother, is he able to identify parts of objects but can't quite identify things that are jumbled together on the table? Does he have difficulty finding silverware, things of that sort?
Yeah, that's right. When the doctor tested him, basically he could do some of the fingers upheld and, of course, a bright light in front of him. But this is fairly sudden, you know, over a period of a year, maybe, or two, that he's had a bad memory for 20-plus years. Mm-hmm. He just seemed like he was a person who always had a bad memory.
Well, typically, this condition progresses slowly as time goes on, and because the logical abilities and memory may be less profoundly affected than in the standard form of Alzheimer's disease, there is some ability to compensate, at least in the initial years. If it is due to Alzheimer's disease, as you know, would be determined by a specialist evaluation, he should be treated with the same sorts of medications that are used to treat Alzheimer's, and he may benefit from occupational therapy to guide recovery of some of the lost visual function. Interestingly, many people who I've seen with this condition over the years retain the ability to find things that are brightly colored or high contrast with the environment, and that can be used, for example, to help him to find the fork at the dinner table or you know, his shaving kit in the cabinet in the bathroom. You just color it with a bright stripe and show him again repeatedly that this is the color to associate with that.
Thank you for calling, Morgan. What about do Alzheimer's patients have moments of clarity and then snap back out sometimes?
We all do. I think the phenomenon that you're referring to is certainly seen in a number of different neurologic disorders. The more profound version of what you're describing is seen in a close cousin to Alzheimer's disease called dementia with Lewy bodies, in which one of the characteristic features is a waxing and waning of alertness and concentration. So those individuals may have lucid periods lasting minutes or hours, days, and then go into a state of very profound confusion. That disorder overlaps Alzheimer's and to some degrees Parkinson's disease, and it's considered actually the second most common form of dementia after Alzheimer's.
I just wanted to add here that a close phenomenon in Alzheimer's disease that some of the listeners maybe have heard of is what we call sundowning, which really refers to the fact that brain function seems to be worse in the evening as compared to earlier in the morning. So as the day progresses, it's often observed that people's skills, brain skills, sort of diminish, in particular in this disease.
Susan from Basking Ridge, New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Leonard. I have a question for the doctors. I have a 95-year-old grandmother in a nursing home. She obviously can't care for herself. She has no memory, but she is able to toilet herself, eat, walk. She's one of the few ambulatory people in her nursing home. And when people ask me what's wrong with my grandmother, I don't know what to say. Does she have dementia? Is she senile? Does she have Alzheimer's? It seems like she can do too many things, and then she can't do some other ones.
If it was Alzheimer's, she wouldn't be able to do those things, right, Dr. Scovias?
Well, it depends on which stage of the disease is at. So, for example, it's not uncommon for people with Alzheimer's disease to retain their ability to walk because this disease does not affect motoric function. And then it's only in the more advanced stages of the disease that what we call basic activities of daily living, which is the ability to feed yourself, your personal hygiene, your ability to be continent, the ability to dress yourself, are affected. So whether she has Alzheimer's disease or not, it's difficult to judge, but it is possible that she may be having memory difficulties. I don't know if it's true, or difficulties with orientation, or difficulties expressing herself or understanding complex things in the setting of preservation of these basic skills.
And these things don't show up the same way in the brain, even though they often look the same?
What do you mean, these things?
Well, all the different kinds of dementia.
There are various ways to distinguish between different types of dementia. So as we said before, the most common form of dementia is Alzheimer's disease. But when we see people in our offices, we do a series of other tests to investigate the possibility of other dementias. Just to give an idea to people, other dementias are the one that Dr. Elkin mentioned before, with a dementia that is called dementia with Lewy bodies, a close cousin of Alzheimer's disease. Other common dementias are what we call vascular dementia, which is loss of brain skills because of strokes. Then we have Parkinson's dementia. So somebody who has many years of Parkinson's disease may have cognitive dysfunction.
What about mad cow disease? Is that related in any way?
So one of the rare forms of dementia is a dementia called Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, which is which belongs to a family of dementias called prion diseases. Another disease that belongs to this family of prion diseases is Creutzfeldt-Jakob variant or mad cow disease, as you mentioned. However, these are very rare forms of dementia, and dementia in relation to consumption of meat has not been reported yet in the United States, at least consumption of meat within the United States.
Now, a listener wonders whether marijuana can delay the onset of Alzheimer's or increase it, and what about alcohol? Have any links been found, Dr. Elkin?
Oh, yes. And again, these are one of or two of several preventatives du jour that have been touted in the press over the past few years. The story, I think, with alcohol is one which is a little more substantive. Just to quickly address the marijuana link, there one of the central ingredients in marijuana, THC, tetrahydrocannabinol, has been shown in a test tube to have some properties that may alter the likelihood that amyloid forms plaques. And with that rather tenuous link, it went straight to the headlines as a potential preventative for Alzheimer's. There's no strong clinical evidence to suggest that's the case. And indeed, chronic marijuana use has been associated with a syndrome of memory loss, not retention of memory. Alcohol is a much more interesting story because certainly years ago we told people who were at risk or who had developed dementia that they should not drink at all. Epidemiologic studies are now suggesting that modest alcohol intake may actually lower the risk of Alzheimer's disease and other forms of dementia. It's unclear whether that effect is due to the presence in certain alcoholic beverages of agents such as resveratrol, the ingredient in red wine that has been linked to longevity and decreased risk of age-related disorders in the French population and in other contexts.
Mostly vascular.
Well, that's a vascular risk factor. There's also the potential for antioxidant effects and other mechanisms. As I mentioned before, it's a complex disease, and when we're talking about intake of a food substance or a change in diet and so forth, there's many, many ways that they can potentially be beneficial. There's really no established way as yet through dietary intake or through medicinal intake to really alter the risk of the disease in a proven way.
And what about mercury and silver? Some people have suggested that they have been linked to Alzheimer's.
The heavy metals are linked to a form of chronic dementia, but not Alzheimer's disease. The metals that may play a role in Alzheimer's disease are metals that help the precipitation of that amyloid protein, copper, zinc, iron, but not in a way that we can link that to dietary intake directly. Those other metals, if they're ingested or inhaled in high quantities, like in occupational exposures, manganese is another example of that, lead to a confusional state that can be very persistent and in some ways resemble Alzheimer's. But when one looks at the brain, it's a different disorder.
Mary, can you make it quick? Mary from Mahwah, New Jersey.
Yeah, I can. I read in the Times that plaque is responsible for a lot of heart attacks, and I've also been told that the cataracts or plaque is there also. And you mentioned plaque. Is that, A, how can it be avoided, and B, does it really play a role in Alzheimer's?
I think there are different types of plaques. So, for example, plaques that may predispose to risk for heart disease or cardiovascular disease in general are what we define as atheromatous plaque, which is like almost like deposition of lipids in the inside aspect of the vessels, of the blood vessels. The plaques in Alzheimer's disease are plaques of a different chemical substance of beta amyloid. However, although the underlying pathology is, the underlying plaques are different, there is some evidence, some epidemiological evidence that protection from cardiovascular disease, like if somebody takes care of their blood pressure, of their cholesterol, of diabetes, in particular diabetes, it may help reducing the risk from Alzheimer's disease.
You can find a link to the Alzheimer's Association at our webpage at wnyc.org. And I want to thank our guests today for being so helpful in explaining Alzheimer's on Please Explain, Dr. Nicolaus Skarmeis of the Columbia University Medical Center and Dr. Norman Relkin of the New York Presbyterian Hospital Weill Cornell Medical Center. Thank you both.